It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. And with me today in the studio is Craig Floyd. Many of our listeners probably recognize the name, though certainly recognize the voice. Craig is the chairman and CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. It's such a mouthful, Craig.
We should rename it. You're right.
The Memorial. I like to refer to your organization as the Memorial Fund. For those of you who do not know what that is, go online. Everybody has a smartphone with them. They can figure it out. But the Memorial Fund has a beautiful memorial down in D.C. at Judiciary Square dedicated to all police officers killed in the line of duty. They're also building a museum. We're going to talk about that with Craig at the end of the show. But we've brought Craig in today to talk about the Memorial Fund's 2011 end-of-year report on law enforcement officer fatalities. They issued that report back in December, and it's got some very interesting statistics, which Craig is going to walk us through. And of course, we're going to talk about some events that I think most Americans couldn't have missed since your report issued involving more fatalities. Craig, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Deborah.
And I mentioned that the report came out in mid-December, and your organization actually collects the data, compiles it, puts it out.
Since 1988, we started collecting data on officers who've been killed in the line of duty. Kind of an interesting story. Quickly, at the time we were building the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, we weren't quite sure whether we should include the names of fallen officers on that memorial. You'll remember that was soon after the Vietnam Veterans Memorial had been built.
Yeah.
Of course, the names of more than 56,000 veterans who had died in that war are inscribed on that beautiful memorial, and it's just riveting. I mean,
if you go down there and you watch people who know the person whose name is on there, it is riveting.
Very compelling. And of course, once they did that, it was almost impossible not to build a memorial without the names on it. So we, of course, made the decision eventually to include names. Now, the problem with that decision was, how do you go about compiling the names and the history of the men and women who've died in the line of duty going back to the 1700s? And initially we said, well, maybe we'll just use the FBI data, which goes back to 1961. And then we said, well, wait a minute, what happens?
That's called modern times.
Well, exactly. And right. What happens to that officer who died on December 31st, 1960? Mm-hmm. We don't include them? Of course we needed to. So eventually we made the right decision. We're going to include every and any officer we could find that qualified and met our criteria. So that began the process in 1988. We've been collecting data on officers ever since. We literally canvassed every agency in the country, asking them, did they have a line of duty death? And if so, give us that information. We had the Attorney General of the United States even send out a letter asking for that information. So since 1988, we've compiled that data. Today, as you know, and our listeners, I think, remember, we have 19,298 names on the National Memorial today. And that dates back to the first death in 1791. Yeah, good memory. Cornelius Hogeboom, who we just found out about this past year.
Which is amazing.
He had been forgotten. And so we discovered his death. He's now on the memorial walls. And as you point out, bringing us up to this year, we announced on December 28th that in the year 2011, up to that point, we had lost 173 officers this year in the line of duty.
In the line of duty. And that means you were on duty at the time.
In most cases, although we do have instances where an off-duty officer whether performing maybe a security detail at maybe a local establishment, or an off-duty officer who sees a robbery in progress and intervenes. Most officers off-duty are carrying their weapons. They have their credentials.
Right, they're authorized.
And so they may lose their life. And in those circumstances, we'll certainly include them as well. But 173 officers. Now,
173 when you issued the report.
Right. And within 3 days, there were only 3 days left in the year. You wouldn't have thought any, if certainly not many officers would die.
Just, I don't want to say it was mind-boggling. It was, I was sort of paralyzed listening to, like, again, another one. And in the last week, there's just been a series of shootings of police officers.
Oh, it's been incredible.
Very brazen.
At the end of 2011, four more officers died, okay, the last 3 days. So that brings our total for the year, based on preliminary information we have, to 177. 71 of those officers were shot and killed, all right? That's a 20% increase over the prior year.
71% were shot and killed.
71 officers were shot and killed.
By a firearm, 20%
right. increase over the prior year. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to 2009, we lost 122 officers that year. That was the best year we'd had fatality-wise in 50 years. All right, we thought we were really seeing a great trend developing. Mm-hmm. Right,
that's 50 less people.
Exactly.
50 and less families.
That's basically, if you do the math, it's roughly about a 43% increase from 2009 to 2011. And that's alarming. And I think everybody...
The Attorney General issued a statement when your report came out, and he had the same reaction.
Well, he has been making this a priority for a couple of years now. He's been very concerned about law enforcement safety and these spike in fatality figures. He convened a law enforcement safety summit back in March. I was proud to attend representing the Memorial Fund, but there were 30 or 40 other law enforcement leaders across the land. The question he asked is, what can we do? What's the problem? How can we prevent these deaths from continuing? And that was back in March. Well, at the end of the year, the deaths did continue. And two common threads seem to come out of that initial meeting. One, there is a relatively small fraction of criminals who are responsible for violent crime in this country, all right? And particularly cop killers. These are people with repeat criminal histories, all right? Rap sheets a mile long. They've assaulted.
It's like utter indifference to the law.
It absolutely is. Disrespect for human life.
Yeah.
Most of them, I don't think, care a whole lot about their own lives. You know, their lives are so troubled as it is. They've basically have taken no advantage of all the wonderful things we have to offer in this country of ours. And so they blame law enforcement. They blame others for their problems. They don't think twice about killing a cop. You know, there's a great statistic. We talk about the profile of cop killers, all right? If you look at that, and that's kept by the FBI, over the last 10 years, 82% of cop killers had prior criminal arrests, all right? Most of them violent crimes.
I was about to ask that.
All right? And 26 of them were actually arrested for murder and for some reason got let out and were walking the streets when they murdered that police officer. They had murdered somebody else previously.
Mm-hmm.
And one out of four cop killers had a history of assaulting a police officer. So this is not the first time they've done this.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like, and I'm sort of curious about your opinion on this, because we're not that many years apart age-wise. I feel like that in the last 20, 30 years, that killing a police, that's on the rise, killing a police officer, that was a very rare event, that it used to be, when somebody was killing a police officer, they were intending, it was suicide. It was called suicide by cop. They were really trying to get themselves killed. If you took a shot at a police officer, you could expect you would get killed. And at least that expression used to hear it in the 70s or the 80s, used to hear suicide by cop, that it was really intended as a way to get yourself killed. Now, when you read these incidents, they actually think they're going to shoot their way out. I mean, when you read some of the incidents related to the fatalities you report, you kind of get the sense that these guys actually, the suspects, they actually think that they're going to somehow shoot their way out of this and escape this event. And that's how they're going to, you know, I don't want to say gain their freedom, but they're not going to get caught. They're going to somehow shoot their way out, which is ludicrous because it's just ludicrous. But to me, that's, if anything, I look at that trend. To me, that looks like the distinction. You didn't see a lot of, I think, back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, you didn't see a lot of people shooting a police officer because they thought somehow that was going to get them their freedom.
I think you're right on so many levels. First of all, the statistics, and I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is that roughly 99% of cop killers are caught. They're either killed, they commit suicide, or they end up in prison basically for the rest of their lives, right, or they're executed.
It is the end of the road when you shoot a police officer.
Your life is basically over at that point in time. As much as you might like to think you're going to escape and live a wonderful life on some beach somewhere, that doesn't happen, all right? The other issue you raise is the historical trends. You have to go back to the 1940s to find a year when fewer than 100 law enforcement officers were killed in a single year. All right, so the 40s, after the war, for example, yes, we had a more peaceful society. Law enforcement officers were not getting killed in anywhere near the numbers we're seeing today. The 50s and 60s, but the 70s, my goodness, 229 officers on average killed every year during the 1970s. So we didn't even see numbers approaching the 70s, even now. The problem is, and there were reasons for that, civil unrest, anti-government sentiment. Officers were not wearing bullet-resistant vests. Mm-hmm. Soft body armor didn't start being available for law enforcement until the mid-70s, and they weren't being worn in great numbers until much later. So a lot of that had to do with the higher number of fatalities. In fact, we like to say today that if not for bullet-resistant vests, we'd have twice as many officers killed in the line of duty as we have. So you got to give a lot of credit to the safety equipment, mm-hmm. to the training, to the increased number of officers. All of that has helped make it safer for our officers.
Yeah, and I actually knew that, and somehow it left my memory, intellectual banks, because I knew that from John Adler, a good friend of mine and of yours, President Flio. I mean, very intense focus on training and officer safety, because that truly does save lives. We do have to take a break. I also want to talk about officer fatalities that were not by firearm, because they deserve an explanation too. And then I want to talk about some of the more recent fatalities. But we do need to take our first break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko. And I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and my guest today is Craig Floyd. He is the chairman and CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. For those of you who are just joining us, the Memorial Fund is located in Washington, D.C., and they've built a very beautiful memorial which inscribes the names of over 19,000 police officers who have died in the U.S. in the line of duty. They're building a museum, which we're going to talk about towards the end of the show. But Craig's with us today to talk about the Memorial Fund's release just about 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit more, of the 2011 end-of-the-year fatality report, Officers Killed in the Line of Duty. And Craig and I were talking about the increase. Would you say it was about 20% increase in fatality by firearm?
Correct. 20% this year versus 2010. And 2010 was a 20% increase in firearms. That's over 2009. So we're seeing some dramatic spikes in law enforcement fatalities, especially by gunfire.
Yeah. And that accounts for the report says 173 fatalities. We know it's actually going to be closer to 177 after everything's verified. Because of the fatalities that occurred at the end of the year, right after your report was issued. So we have about 177 names, and 71
were shot and killed.
Shot and killed. Yeah. That leaves over about 100 officers who died by some other means.
Most of those additional deaths were by traffic-related incidents. Interestingly, Deborah, and this is a little bit of good news that was in this year's report, about the only good news, really. Mm-hmm. Traffic-related fatalities had outpaced gunfire fatalities mm-hmm. for 13 years in a row. All right, we've had more officers killed in traffic-related incidents 13 years in a row. This year, 2011, we actually saw more officers killed by gunfire. For the first time in 14 years. Now, two reasons for that. One, firearms-related fatalities have gone up, mm-hmm. all right, as we've talked about, and traffic-related fatalities have actually gone down.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, does that number account for the fact that the fatalities in a traffic-related event have declined, or is it just that there are more firearms fatalities?
Little of both, and firearms are up. But traffic-related fatalities in 2011 numbered 64. That was the second lowest figure for traffic-related fatalities in the last 15 years. All right, so that's good news. We've been very concerned for many years about the escalation in traffic-related fatalities. And these are preventable deaths. Mm-hmm. My goodness, if you're looking at what are the most preventable deaths among law enforcement, I mean, the criminal that wants to assassinate a cop, there's not a whole lot we can do, frankly.
That's the danger of the job, you know?
It is. And that criminal has the advantage, obviously. The officer's in uniform, driving a marked cruiser, coming up to a traffic light. We saw it this year on a couple of occasions. Criminal just pulls up alongside and opens fire for no reason at all. It's tough to protect those officers in those situations. But when an officer is responding to an emergency call and dies in a single car crash, which happens in about 43% of the cases of auto-related fatalities for law enforcement, about 43% are single vehicle crashes. That means that officer didn't crash into another car that maybe got in its way. They were maybe driving a little too fast for the conditions. You know, could have been a rainy, ice-slickened road, a little excessive speed. You know, let's think about it. Officers have this instinct in them, and they're trained to every second counts. Could be a life or death situation for that innocent person in need. I want to get there fast. Mm-hmm. And they put themselves at great risk to try to save that innocent life. It's not because they're reckless. It's because they care enough about the people they're trying to help and save. And sometimes they put themselves at an unnecessary risk, really.
And you and I, when you were on the show just a few months ago, catching up on the museum, we talked, because that's what your museum is dedicated to, or the memorial is the fatalities. And we talked about, just very briefly, if you recall, how officers are killed in the line of duty. And I was talking with you about traffic fatalities and how there's, when I'm on the highway at night and you see an officer, particularly, you know, in Metro DC, where I think, you know, we always rate either the second or third worst traffic in the country. You know, you see the officer, see the vehicle, the police vehicle with its lights on, pulled sort of diagonally off the side of the road, trying to get the flow of traffic around him. And I get this nervous, like, slow down, because I sort of somehow know this is how a lot of police officers get killed, on the side of the road, making a traffic stop. And I thought, you said something that I thought was very interesting that I didn't know, that there were these studies that showed at night that when people drive, they actually tend to drive into where the lights are.
Yeah, it's almost like a magnet that flashing light actually draws that drunken or drowsy driver to the lights. And that means they crash into the rear end of that squad car parked on the side of the road. The officer is a sitting duck, and they often die in those situations.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, you were so used to lights and sirens, so I was sort of thinking about that since we talked, and you wonder if that's the physiology, if that's human physiology, what's the technological response to save? It is a very dangerous, in metropolitan congested areas, it's dangerous when they pull people off on the side of the road for a traffic stop. It's just dangerous for everybody.
No, it is. And we, the driving public, often don't recognize the dangers that officers dealing with. That's why in 49 states in this country now, Deborah, we have a law called Move Over and Slow Down. All right. It is the law of the land. What you just said you do instinctually, you should have done because it's the law. You are required to slow down in any situation when you have an emergency vehicle on the side of the roadway. Or, you know, theoretically, and it isn't going to happen all that often, you're going to get arrested for not doing so.
Right. They're busy already. They're on the side of the road with somebody else.
Exactly. But it's an important marketing campaign that we get people to think the way you thought instinctually. That's why we have these laws.
But I didn't even know there was a law.
Well, most people don't.
I would say the marketing campaign's failing.
It's failing, and that's why we're on the show today talking about it, and that's why we talk about it all the time. It's Move Over and Slow Down. If you're on a multi-lane road, an interstate, for example, you also are required to move over a lane. Give that officer that added margin of safety. They're putting their life at great risk by either making a traffic stop because of a violator, somebody that's driving recklessly, all right? They're trying to keep us safe from those reckless drivers. But meanwhile, they're getting out of the car. Cars whizzing by 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, a few inches away, really. And there's a thing I've heard troopers talk about sometimes, crazy as it sounds, something called dusting, where some truck drivers have been known to maybe see how close they could get to those officers. It's almost a game in some cases. Can you imagine that?
That's really pathetic.
It is. And I've heard officers being hurt and killed in those situations. It doesn't happen often, obviously. But the point is, if we're not paying attention, the driving public, we're doing a text, we're doing an email, we're
going
talking
too fast
on the phone, we're driving too fast, we've had too much to drink.
We're tired, we're sleeping.
We're tired, we're dozing off. All of those situations put that officer who's just a foot or two away in grave danger. So move over and slow down. And it seems to be maybe paying some dividends. This year, I think the number was 11 officers struck and killed on the side of roadway. Mm-hmm. Last year, the number was 16. So we saw a pretty dramatic decrease in the number of officers struck and killed this year.
And you know, Craig, that we have our weekly e-report Fed Agent, where we report the weekly top news for federal law enforcement. And I think I'm going to do something in there regularly to promote the Move Over, Slow Down, because I feel I'm very law-abiding. I didn't know that 49 states had these laws. So we're with you to help you figure out a way to get that campaign slogan out. Because even just in 2011, I can't remember exactly the incident, but I do remember watching. I watch the local news at night, and I do remember watching and seeing several, you know, local incidents where police officers were either killed or injured. On a routine, no crime involved traffic stop because of road conditions and because of, it was nighttime and it was raining and people couldn't see or it was trafficy and they somehow, you know, they wander off the road and the officer gets killed. And it's tragic, you know, because quote unquote, it was routine, you know, as opposed to, or officers, I think, expect when they're going into a situation where a crime is in progress, they're expecting that this is going to be very dangerous to their own personal, you know, safety. But traffic violation, it should be routine and it should be very safe. And I think the roadways have gotten away from us in many metropolitan areas. I think drivers feel that way. And it's not surprising to hear police officers feel that way. So I'm all for helping you and your campaign for Move Over and Slow Down. I like it.
By the way, most of the deaths that occur when an officer is struck and killed occur at accident scenes and construction sites, not so much traffic stops. So, you know, don't be thinking that, hey, the officer is always pulling people over. Maybe they shouldn't be as aggressive, and that might help save their lives. They're out there helping stranded motorists, responding to accidents, helping keep traffic and drivers safe at construction sites. And they're at great risk, and we don't even think about it.
Yeah, and I think actually the sense of the public, at least in this area, is that there's not enough police on the roadways pulling people over for going too fast, for texting and driving. I've heard that recently where people were like relaying a story about driving on one of our roads, the Beltway or 95, and complaining that, you know, somebody was going like 90 miles an hour weaving or texting or whatever, and there wasn't a police officer in sight, you know, and the volume on our roads, you know, I think it's just outpaced, and we're going to talk about that after our break. It's outpaced resources, and particularly after the recession, what so many police departments, state and local, had to do to cut back, you know, and cut personnel.
Budget cuts are hurting us all. They're making it tougher on the officers and tougher on the citizens.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about that as what's showing up in the statistics. How is it affecting everybody's safety? But we do need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now, this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact Geico. Tell them, Mike.
Hey folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune in to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and my guest today is Craig Floyd. He is the chairman and CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Craig's with us today to talk about the year-end report that they just issued, the 2011 year-end report on law enforcement officer fatalities. If you've been listening, you know that that number now is at 177 nationwide. And Craig, you have the statistic of how many of the 177 were federal law enforcement.
Yeah, feds this past year suffered greatly, like so many officers across this country. Interestingly, Florida led the nation with 14 law enforcement fatalities. Texas was second with 13. But when you look at federal agents killed in the line of duty, 12 federal agents killed in the line of duty
this
in 2011.
Year? I mean, yeah, 2011. Yeah. And, yeah. And just like the other statistics, it's up. When I read your press releases and your report and online, it was 12 feds in 2011. In 2010, it was 9. And in 2009, it was 6. So it's doubled in 2 years.
And I can't help but think back, Deborah, to a year not too long ago, probably about 5 years ago. I can't remember the exact date. But we went the entire year without losing a federal officer until, the last day of the year, and then an officer died. But we had only one in that particular year, and now we're talking about 12 federal officers being killed in the line of duty. As I look down the list, I see two from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Special Agents Timothy Briggs and Daniel Knapp. People may remember Special Agent Knapp actually died toward the end of the year on December 29th, drowned in Puerto Rico, where he was stationed while attempting to rescue a distressed swimmer. So he actually put his life at great risk to rescue someone else in need. Two from the Customs and Border Protection Agency, Border Patrol agents Hector Clark and Eduardo Rojas Jr.
I think they died in the same event.
Yes, they both died on May 12th, 2011, a very tragic circumstance. Two from the U.S. Department of the Interior, Park Ranger Chris Nickel and Park Ranger Julie Ware. Two from the U.S. Marshal Service, Deputy Marshal Derek Hotzenpiller and Deputy Marshal John Perry. One from the ATF, Special Agent John Capano, the last officer killed in 2011. He was shot and killed while attempting to subdue a robbery suspect in New York. And one from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Senior Officer Specialist Christopher Cooper, back in April. One from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, ICE, Special Agent Jamie Zabata. And one from the U.S. Park Police toward the end of the year, also here locally in the D.C. area, Sergeant Michael Baim, back on December 19th, responding to rescue someone who had jumped off a bridge trying to commit suicide. He suffered a fatal heart attack during that very stressful situation.
Oh, I do remember seeing that on the news. Many of our listeners may think that we counted and failed to report correctly on the park ranger deaths, and that's because that death, which is so fresh in our minds, occurred in 2012. And I think, Craig, though it's worth mentioning, it was one day into the new year.
Margaret Anderson, something that got really nationwide attention. It was in Mount Rainier, and she was shot and killed while attempting to stop a fleeing suspect. The first federal law enforcement fatality of 2012, and in fact, the first fatality nationwide in 2012.
Yeah, and it's a maniac kind of situation. She actually was killed putting up a roadblock to catch the suspect. He drives up, gets out of his car, and I believe it was a high-powered
assault rifle.
Yeah, assault rifle, and the details beyond that, I have not seen anywhere in the news. I haven't seen whether she was aware that he was there, even pulled her weapon. I've seen nothing. The only details I've seen are how they found him and his past history. But what actually happened right there and then I haven't seen. And I think eventually it'll all come out. And since even though it was the first of the year in 2012, there were two other park ranger deaths. And so you wonder, and I watched several of the interviews on TV of her colleagues, Margaret Anderson's colleagues being interviewed, and they themselves verbalized the surprise that the job is now dealing with violent offenders, that they themselves think that the national parks are places where people come for tranquility and recreation and to enjoy, nature. And they're verbalized the surprise that violence has now entered the park system. You have to wonder what the National Park Service, how they're going to react in terms of training and equipment, anything to deal with that event. Is it an anomaly? Is it a trend?
I think you're onto something that we're seeing this level of violence crossing all borders. There really is no sacred place anymore. If you're a law enforcement officer, you're at risk. I mean, who would have thought that three park rangers and one park police officer would have been killed in the last several months? That's almost unheard of.
Yeah.
I mean, have we lost park rangers and park police officers in the past? Sure, but fewer than 10. And I think this number that we've seen in the past year is unprecedented. And I think it does speak to the level of violence that's being committed nationwide. You know, we often talk about a more brazen, cold-blooded criminal out on the streets of America and in the parklands. And I think this bears witness to that, criminals are not thinking twice about killing police officers, assaulting police officers. Some are desperate. Some simply don't want to go back to prison or jail. Some are mentally deranged. And for some reason, despite our laws preventing people with a history of mental illness to purchase and obtain firearms, they're getting their hands on them.
Yeah.
We saw it down in Tucson, Arizona. We were talking offline about Gabby Giffords getting a shot and so many people dying in Tucson. That was a man with a clear history of mental illness, had an arsenal of weapons that he was able to purchase.
On the internet.
Exactly.
And which, they talk about the loopholes in federal gun laws, and it must be that he got them through those loopholes.
And you don't want... The point is, we have these laws in place that need to be enforced, and it's tough sometimes because you don't know in some cases who has a history of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
What is the database that gun dealers are going to go to get that information? It's not readily available like we'd expect it to be.
Do they self-report? Is that how does that occur? How do they know that the person has a history of mental illness?
Good question. I think part of it is self-reporting by the person purchasing the weapon. I'm not an expert in that area. I don't want to pretend to be one. But I know I've heard from many law enforcement officials that say, that's one of the real flaws in our system is that, yes, we don't want people with histories of mental illness to obtain weaponry. But how's the gun dealer going to know the difference? And unfortunately, too many of them are getting their hands on weapons. And with their mental instability, they do crazy things. We certainly saw it in Tucson. We saw it at Virginia Tech a few years ago when the student killed, I believe, 32 other people that day. I mean, it was crazy. And he should not have had the ability to purchase weapons.
Yeah. And you sort of get you hear from if you offline, not out in the public, but you hear from police officers and just through my work. That they feel outpowered sometimes by public citizens, and I was wondering in that there was a sense that a growing sense that the arsenals in the hands of the public was outdoing what police officers had available to them, and now with the budget cuts, which are well known in the last 2 years. Not so much at the federal level, but certainly state and local, where most citizens meet law enforcement. It's at the state and local level.
Absolutely. And budget cuts, I think, have decimated so many law enforcement agencies. I opened up the internet the other day and saw 100 Detroit police officers are being laid off because they've run out of money to pay for their salaries. All right. That's tough. Detroit's got a lot of crime, a lot of officers being assaulted in Detroit, and now we're cutting back by 100. That's a huge loss there.
It's a huge loss to the citizens who want the protection, but like I said, I've learned from my good friend John Adler, it's an enormous safety issue for the men and women who remain in the police department and go to work, because you lose 100 and you lose backup, you lose more foot, you lose more people around you, you lose the number of people you could bring to an event, some sort of law enforcement encounter. It has enormous repercussions, both to citizens and the officers.
Think about back to the days of the Clinton administration when they came out with the cops law, basically, that increased law enforcement by about 100,000 officers, right? Everybody was giving a lot of credit to that increase in law enforcement manpower for the reduction in violent crime. And also there was a rather substantial reduction in law enforcement fatalities around that time. A lot of people have said the reason officer fatalities have gone down since the 1970s are better equipment, better training, more technology, and more officers on the street. Okay, just as you pointed out, they back each other up. The visible presence of law enforcement is a deterrent to crime. A show of force by law enforcement in potentially volatile situations helps to depress the resistance factor. A brazen criminal may want to shoot it out with one cop, but if there's three or four cops coming at him, he may think twice.
Especially if he isn't trying to do suicide side by cop.
Well, exactly. And they'd rather just go to jail quietly in those situations. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, I was just thinking about their survey they recently did. They found that 60% of responding agencies had cut back on training in the past year, 64% had cut back on buying or upgrading equipment, 58% had cut back on buying or upgrading technology, and the Department of Justice just recently came out with a report saying by the end of 2011, they were projecting 12,000 police officers and deputies who would be laid off by the end of the year. So 12,000 fewer officers. And then on top of that, we just saw 100 fewer in Detroit. I'm sure we're going to see more reductions. It's only going to get worse before it gets better, I'm afraid. And that means citizens are at risk and officer safety is at risk.
And it also becomes sort of like a circuitous event, because then citizens feeling less secure, it's an encouragement to arm themselves, and then they arm themselves, they're in a situation that they can't figure out, somebody gets hurt who shouldn't. It really, you know, I always say this, it pays to bring in the professionals, and in law enforcement, it's the police. And when you have as large a population as you have in the U.S. with gun laws that allow people to be, you know, to have their own weapons and to buy guns as freely as they can, it's you kind of think maybe you are heading back into the 70s with where we might head with all these reductions in personnel. And I do want to talk more about that with you, Craig, but we need to take the final break of our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum, but there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good, which brings me to the big news. GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing, or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to GEICO. So no matter if you're blue or red, or in my case, green. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, contact GEICO and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. This is Deborah Roth, and I'm joined today by my guest, Craig Floyd, who's the chairman and CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. They issued just a few weeks ago, end of 2011, they issued the 2011 end-of-year report on law enforcement officer fatalities, and Craig and I have spent a good part of the show talking about that. And while we were on break, Craig raised this point with me, which I want to raise on air, because I did know this because we reported on it in Fed Agent. In 2011, the Justice Department reported that the incidence of violent crimes was down, the crime was down. I think, is that also true in 2010?
Yes.
So if the incidence of crime is down, and here we are having reductions in police officers, but officer police fatality is up, how do you explain, what's the correlation, if any, there? It seems disjointed. Crime is down, personnel is down, fatality is up.
There's a number of factors. A kind of interesting discussion on this subject. First of all, you've got to realize that over the past 100 years, virtually up until very recently, we saw the homicide rate in this nation almost mirroring exactly the felonious fatality rate for law enforcement officers. When homicide rates go up, the felonious fatalities of officers goes up the same amount.
Okay.
When they go down, they both go down the same amount. So that's history. Now, the last couple years, look at what's happened. Mm-hmm. The violent crime rate in this country has gone down. Mm-hmm. Homicides have gone down. And yet last year we saw, and I say last year, 2010, we saw about a 20% increase in the number of officers killed feloniously. We saw another 20% increase this year in the number of officers killed feloniously, a 42% increase basically over the last 2 years in officer fatalities at a time when the homicide rate and the crime rate's going down. Now, why is that? Well, it's only speculation, obviously, but let's look at some of the factors at work. I think we have a more desperate criminal, all right? We've gotten tougher with criminal justice in this country.
Yeah.
A lot of these criminals who've been in and out of prison for a long time, a big part of their lives, they don't want to go back. All right. So they're taking their chances on shooting it out with the police. Now, another factor I think that's at work is a very strong anti-government, anti-establishment mentality. All right. A lot of that is fed by this bashing of Congress, bashing the president, blaming the government for our people that are out of work, all sorts of troubles that have been the result of the economy. So who do you blame for that? Well, a lot of people want to blame government, want to blame the establishment, the people in charge. Who is the most visible and vulnerable symbol of government and the establishment in this country? It's law enforcement.
Yeah, they're in a uniform.
So, you know, thus, maybe you have more of that, the rage,
there's more
the
anger.
Frustration, the anger being taken out on law enforcement.
Yeah.
And we're all saying, well, geez, I'm surprised we're not seeing more crime with the economy the way it is. Well, you know, that's maybe harder to explain, and I'll leave it to the experts to talk more about that in historical terms. But I think it's somewhat apparent that couple those two factors with the fact that technology has allowed officers, we've gotten smarter with the way we approach crime in this country. We know where the trouble spots are now. And officers are able to get there much more quickly. A lot of times the high crime areas are being saturated with law enforcement. There's all kinds of technology and communications improvements that have allowed officers to respond quicker to crimes in progress. It means there's going to be more of a confrontation between the officer and the criminal. And that puts the officer at risk.
Right.
If there's a gun battle with that fleeing criminal, the cops are in jeopardy. Not so much the innocent citizens in those situations.
Yeah.
It's a cop.
Yeah, it's interesting because you say it's a 100-year history, and in the last 2 years, the numbers break in opposite directions. And you have to wonder, is that just an anomaly that has no basis in, you know, a fact? Or is there something going on there? And your explanation, I think, some of the hypothesis you have makes sense to me because even before the recession, there was an enormous amount of intense anger, partisan anger that you hear on the airwaves by our politicians against each other, between branches of government, you know, the White House and Congress, Congress and the White House. And then you hear it filtering out of government. You hear it on talk radio. You see it on websites. The partisanship, the politics of our country, and people said that about Gabby Giffords, you know, when she was shot. They wonder to what extent he was motivated by the partisanship. I'm not sure. I haven't followed it closely enough, so I don't know how that panned out. But a lot of people, even politicians, talk about how angry our country has become. And I think you make a good point that you're kind of seeing it on the street where citizen meets who are they going to meet that's a government official? They're not meeting their congressman and senator. They're meeting the police officer.
Right. And it puts our officers at great risk, knowing that they are literally sitting ducks. If a person wants to take out their anger and rage against an officer, they see them sitting in the squad car next to them at a traffic light. And they open fire? I mean, how do you explain that?
Right, how do you explain
that? I mean, if you or I were sitting next to them, there's a good chance they wouldn't have opened fire on us. But no, they look across, that's a marked cruiser, officer in uniform, they become a target, you know, even though that officer had no interaction with them. We saw that several times this past year.
The fatalities.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, when you read these stories, Jeremy Henwood, one of the great stories, I think, in terms of such a wonderful person. He was a San Diego police officer, had a tour or multiple tours, I think it was, in Iraq and Afghanistan. He came back and he served as a San Diego police officer. He was videotaped in a McDonald's moments before his death, paying for lunch for a young boy who needed some help. All right. So he pays for his lunch, gives him a little teaching moment, and then leaves him on his way after some encouraging words. And he gets in his car. He goes out onto the street, sits at a traffic light.
You mean in his police cruiser?
Police cruiser. He's sitting at a traffic light, and a criminal who had been fleeing other police in another area drives up next to him and opens fire. Explain that.
What's that about?
Yeah, it's rage. It's this guy with a troubled life being chased by some other cops. He says, you know, enough's enough. I've had it with these cops chasing me for committing crimes, you know. I'm going to kill one of them. And he just launches
I'll show
an
you
attack.
Kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's utter indifference. You know, and a lot of people, you know, I don't know if it goes on in your household, who watches the local news and who doesn't? Because in many areas where you watch the local news, it's only about what crime occurred that day. I think in Metro D.C., it's just different local news because it is the seat of government. So you see a lot more, you know, local news reports a lot more on things other than crime. But when you leave the Metro D.C. area and you go to other parts of the country, people are saturated by it. Now, it's always been sort of the case that local news is all about, you know, what crime occurred today. It just seems that it's gotten, you know, you get the sense people are almost, there's a reticence about going out in places in public, you know, that used to be considered safe. We had here in D.C., we had the D.C. area, we had some guy who was going around in the mall and slicing women with a knife on their, it just seems that the violent encounters have gotten ratcheted up. And that statistic from DOJ, I was surprised when I saw it a couple of months ago. I was surprised. And so is it just our typical news media, you know, getting it all out there in our face? You know, it just feels our society, I think for many people, would say it feels more violent than it's ever been. And that brings me back to all these budget cuts and personnel cuts. Department of Justice, Eric Holder, Attorney General, when you issued your report, he issued an announcement. He laid out a whole bunch of programs that the department has in place or putting in place to help community police forces deal with the issue of fatalities.
Yeah, one of those important part of the program that he's talking about, it's called the Valor Program, by the way. It's a law enforcement safety initiative that he's spearheaded and championed. He's all about making it safer for our officers. I've never seen anybody more dedicated to that issue. And part of it is providing money for bullet-resistant vests for every officer. I'm hearing reports, Deborah, that up to 20% of the officers in this country are still not being provided with the bullet-resistant vest by their agencies, and that is absolutely unacceptable. Those vests have proven to save more than 3,100 police lives over the last 20 years or so. Every officer must have a bullet-resistant vest and must wear those vests, all right? Part of the money is for training and for important messaging, community outreach to the law enforcement community. We're part of that. We're partnering with the Department of Justice, with the Bureau of Justice Assistance, with the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. In fact, later this month, January 26, we'll be hosting at our offices a meeting of a group called the Officer Safety and Wellness Group. And this is a joint project of the Bureau of Justice Assistance and the COPS office at DOJ with groups like us that are all focused on what can we do to make it safer for our officers. And this will be the second full meeting of that group. The Attorney General will be there and he will speak and he will lead the discussion. And we're going to hopefully come out of that meeting with some good ideas and initiatives that will hopefully address this very serious problem.
Wow, that's truly amazing. We have less than a minute left in our show, and I did want to comment on that when you look at the state and local level, the budget cuts, I mean, they're just, state and locals, they're just grappling with reduced tax bases, people out of work, real estate price, housing decline. So their tax bases decline. You know, you think the feds would come in, and I was very impressed to see what the Justice Department, the programs it's putting in place. So we'll wait and see how that works out for people in the coming year.
Well, in tight fiscal times, I mean, federal dollars are precious. And the fact that they're putting over $80 million toward law enforcement safety, I think, tells you where this administration stands on that issue.
Yeah. So we will have Craig back for Police Week in April to Welcome in Police Week, and I want to thank you, Craig, for joining us, you know, before Police Week to talk about the end of the year report, and best wishes.
Thank you.